Okay, now be a good time to turn down the phones. Boker tov. First of all, my apologies for 2 weeks ago, Yom Yerushalayim, the week before Yom Yerushalayim. We haven't met for 3 weeks now. The week of Yom Yerushalayim, we had a shiur that Wednesday, and then Shavuot was Shavuot on Wednesday. And then I was in Poland last week, and there were no Torah tickets that came out for Parshat Naso, because there was a double issue with Shavuot, and I've forgotten 3 weeks ago to let you know that last week I wouldn't be here, there'd be a substitute, so I'm sure it was not Bitul Torah, and whoever came, I'm sure you learned something nice and so on, but we are back. Until the next time, I'll be away sometime in the middle of the summer. Okay, today we're going to go back to Rambam Sefer Mitzvot, specifically with regard to today's calendar date, the 20th of Sivan. For most people, the 20th of Sivan is simply the day after the 19th of Sivan and the day before the 21st, right? But it does have significance in the Jewish calendar. It was actually, since 1648, an official fast day that was regional. And this is a very, very good topic for myself, coming back from Poland Monday morning, because we dealt with the issue of the Gzerot Tachvatat. Tachvatat is Tavchet and Tavtet. The years Tavchet and Tavtet was the year 1648. In the middle of the 17th century, there was the revolt of the Cossacks led by Khmelnytsky, at which time massive Jewish destruction took place of Kihilot, of people. There's usually a machloket, dispute of how many perished, and somehow the numbers are very extreme, from 10,000 to 100,000. But whatever it was no question it was massive. And the one who suggested that there should be a fast day on the 20th of Sivan, and the minute will show why the 20th Sivan, when these attacks took place in the course of 2.5 years. But nevertheless, there was a date that was zeroed in on the 20th of Sivan, and it was established by Rabbi Shabtai Cohen, who's known as the Shach. Rabbi Shabtai Cohen was a commentary posek on the Shulchan Aruch Yerodea. Everybody knows who learns Yerodea, the first section for Smicha, has to delve into the Shach and the Taz. I happen to be a somewhat of a descendant from the Shach, not Ben Achar Ben, but over 10 generations ago, where was Ben Achar Ben, then some grandmother is there. We know that the Shach marries the granddaughter of the Ramah, which makes me a descendant of the Ramah as well. But the Shach, Rabbi Shabtai Cohen, he ordained, suggested the fast day, but as we have in many areas of additions to the calendar or additions to liturgy, one person doesn't do it. You cannot have an individual and you expect that it should be accepted by all. Indeed, there was a governing body that consisted of rabbinic and lay leaders that functioned for over 200 years, from the 16th to the 18th century, called the Vad Arba Arotzot, the Council of Four Lands. And the Four Lands, they incorporated Poland and Prussia and Lithuania, and there was another section that had a different name, but it's this general area of eastern Poland, what today would be eastern Poland, and some sliver of western Germany and Lithuania, and maybe what we call today Belarus, which then was Poland also. So this governing body sat in what was then the capital of Poland, Lublin. Then that was like the main center. And they kept tabs on Am Yisrael, from a communal point of view and from a religious point of view. And it was the Vad Arba Arotzot, the Council of Four Lands, that indeed sanctioned the fast day of the 20th of Sivan for all the people in this region. In other words, they didn't have authority to talk about Jews elsewhere, but for all the Jews of this region, that it would be a fast day. And it's interesting, fast day for men 18 years old and up, and a fast day for women 15 years old and up. Exactly why that difference happened, until this very day, I don't know, but I did see that recorded. And it would be a day of saying of slichot. Now, if we just jump to modern days, there are a handful, literally a handful of Kihilot Yisrael that still say the slichot of the 20th of Sivan. How many people actually fast on the 20th of Sivan is as marginal as you can get. But I read that the community of the Bells of Hasidim, they still say the slichot, and other communities that that hail from these areas, if there's still a community left, because what happened after the Shoah, there's no such thing as a community anymore, except for maybe the Breuer's community of Washington Heights, but that has nothing to do with Gzeirat Tafatat. They weren't there in Germany. The Chelmenitschke pogroms hit the city of Zhezhov, which is Jews called it Reisha. It hit it very hard, and Bialystok in the northeast of Poland today. These cities really got hit badly, and Lublin for sure, and many, many Jews perished in the wave of these pogroms. Now, to the Poles, Chelmenitsky was, to the Ukrainians rather, to the Ukrainians, today Chelmenitsky's area is Ukraine, he was a national hero. He was a national hero, there's a monument to him and everything. They never saw him as a murderer, because what he was doing was trying to break the yoke of the then existing monarchy that was built on economic wealth. And who do you think helped the monarchy in its economic wealth? The Jews. They're always involved in it. And that's why the Jews got hit. So from a Polish nationalistic point of view, the Jews deserved it. And Chelmenitschke was made into a national hero. But from our point of view, it was a shechita. It was a mini Shoah of sorts. It wasn't as encompassing as the Shoah, not in numbers nor in kilot, in the area. But nevertheless, it was a very, very big, you know, in Yiddish we say klap, a bang, very big bang. And there was a reaction by the Vat Arba Ratzot. But I mentioned that one person cannot institute. I remember when we dealt with Tfilah many years ago, I pointed out that the inclusion of the bracha of V'la Malshinim, the bracha of that was added on to the Shmon Esrei and now became Chasrei Brachot. Our Shmon Esrei is not 18. 18 is just a generic name, but it has 19 Brachot. B'lam HaShinim, and some begin it with Alaminim, which was the Bracha that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should eradicate essentially the early Hebrew Christians. Those are the Minim, but they looked like us, they davened like us, they dressed like us, and they just acted a little frumer. And that's right, the first generation of Christianity were all true Orthodox Jews. That's who they were. And then, because it was not accepted by the mainstream, they turned to the Gentile world, and that's where they really took off, big time. But the original Christians who believed in Yeshua and all kinds of messianic ideas, this group, we couldn't fight them. Sometimes you didn't even know who they were. So there was a tefillah that was instituted, and the Gemara identifies one of the Amoraim, Shmuel HaKatan, Tanaim, Shmuel HaKatan, to he authored the bracha of Olam HaShinim. When the Rambam talks about this in Halakha, he says, "Bimei Rabbi Gamliel beidino." Days of Rabbi Gamliel and his beit din, his Sanhedrin, the 19th bracha was added on. But why does he mention Shmuel HaKatan? Because Shmuel HaKatan is an individual. An individual does not author new tefillot. Does not. He can author, but he doesn't have the authority to institute that Am Yisrael is going to say a new bracha. But if it comes out of the official Sanhedrin, that's a different idea, different ballgame. I mean, there, obviously, they have authority to do so. So that's how the Rambam is. And I always use as an analogy the Tfilah L'Shlom HaMdina. Tfilah L'Shlom HaMdina, I always ask people, you know, who wrote it? People say Rav Herzog. Where do we know that it was Shai Agnon? Shai Agnon, Rav Herzog asked Agnon to help him with it. And Rav Herzog was probably put on the final touches. Rav Herzog had input in terms of the theme of the content of the Tfilah L'Shlom HaMdina. But the literary formulation was Agnon. But officially, it was issued by the chief rabbinate. A person, Shai Agnon, doesn't give Am Yisrael a tefillah, nor does Rav Herzog as a person, but it was officially given out by the chief rabbinate. That's an institution. Whether you hold the institution or not, it's a different story, but it was institutionalized by the Rabbanut HaRashit. And we're going to see a question towards the end of the shiur from Rav Moshe Feinstein, which is also number 4. So how come we don't have a day of fasting with Slichot after the Shoah? I mean, you can make what's called a Kal V'Chomer. if after the Gezeirat Tachfetat, which was limited in scope, again, 100,000 Jews perishing is not a small thing, but you know, put it against 6 million and put it against the area that was covered by Nazi Germany, Yimach Shemam, so clearly the Gezeirat Tachfetat was more limited in scope, yet there was a not just a feeling, but an action was taken to institute a fast day with Slichot. So how come after the Shoah, there's no parallel that covers this? We'll see this in a few minutes. But the Slichot, I have a Siddur that I got from my Bar Mitzvah. It's called Otzar HaTfilot. And it incorporates many, many things that we don't have in our day-to-day Siddur. So it has the Slichot of the 20th of Sivan. And it gives very much the background of these Tfilot. So just going through the Slichot, I didn't print out any of this Slichot, but I'm just going to tell you who authored this Slichot, because many times the author is known by, he signs off by an acrostic. You can see the name at the end of the kina. Sometimes the kina is Aleph Bet. For example, this very first one, Ani Yom Ira Elecha Ekra. That's Aleph, Ani. Bal, that's a Bet. Ya'ashkuni Zedim Ozve Yekara. Gimel, Gimul Lahem Lashiv Shem Levakra. Dalet, Din Rasha Ve'aval Meloam Yikra. It's Aleph Bet. The whole thing is Aleph Bet. Until it gets to the very end, Shefet, that's a Shin, Ra'a Tavi Aleim Va'ashimem, Lamo, that's a Lamed, Olel Vitolel Bechoved Yishimem, Minat, Mem, his name is Shlomo, Hashivem is the Hey, and then it says Hey Kuf Tet Nun, Hakatan, Shlomo Hakatan, that's how he was known, and we do know who the Shlomo Hakatan is, and that's one Kina, and then there's another one, that's Shlomo Hakatan, second one, and then there's another one that's Hillel ben Yaakov, and on further, Meir ben Rabbi Yitzchak. So the question is, who are the authors? Who are these people? Where many of them we're not familiar with when we deal with the regular keynote, but one is pretty much not known. Gershom. Bar Yehuda. Who is Gershom Bar Yehuda? He's the famous Rabbeinu Gershom Me'or HaGola. You know, the one who had the Cherem against marrying two women, Cherem reading somebody else's mail. All this is, when is Rabbeinu Gershom? The end of the 10th century, the 11th century. So, one second. What is Rabbeinu Gershom doing, having a slichas here, a kina, a slichas / kina, for an event that happened in the 17th century, 1648? So the answer is, that when they established, so number one, not only is he from the Middle Ages, but Shlomo Katan is also from the Middle Ages, and Meir ben Yitzchak is from the Middle Ages. These are slichot that existed, but were never part of the official liturgy. Not all of the slichot, and not all of the kinot for Tisha B'Av made it into the book. So there were still isolated slichot and kinot that were extant, but were never part of the official liturgy for any particular occasion, for any tzom, or for slichas for Yom Neroim, or whatever, or for Tisha B'Av. What happened here was, again, an event that happened in the course of 2.5 years. You can pick out of a hat any date, just like the Shoah. You can pick out of a hat any date. You want to memorialize the Shoah? So pick out a date. So today is June 14th in the secular calendar, and the in Poland, they decided that today is going to be a commemoration day for the first mishloach, the first transport to Auschwitz. And where was the first transport to Auschwitz? It came from the town of Tarnów. And Tarnów is a city in Galicia, what the Jews call Tuna. And it was in 1940, on June 13th, 1940. And what happened on June 13th, 1940? This has nothing at all to do with Jews. It has nothing to do with the Shoah. But it has to do with German atrocities. Is when they rounded up Polish dissidents, Polish intellectuals. So some of them happened to have been Jewish. But the majority of the people that were rounded up in the city of Tarnów, and there's a memorial today, not far from the remnant of the shul that hardly survives in the city of Tarnów, but there's a monument there. And we take the groups there. We talk about the first mishloach, the first transport to Auschwitz. It was about 750 people, 770 people. And in Poland today, there is a memorial. The day after, June 14th. I saw the paper today in the Post. I didn't know this myself. Last week I was there. I didn't know that on June 14th the Poles have a Yom HaZikaron of sorts for the Mishloach to Auschwitz. And what's interesting is that all the monuments that were erected by the Poles shortly after the war, after World War II, of Shoah importance, you never see the word Jews. They were Polish citizens. You know, the Germans killed 3 million Polish citizens. That's what they did. And that's why there's a need to memorialize them. They never really put the finger on the fact that there was a war against the Jews. As the writer Lucy Davidowitz wrote a whole book on this, that there were two wars going on simultaneously. There was World War II, and then there was a war on the Jews. And war on the Jews, even though the war in World War II was going so badly for the Germans, but the war on the Jews was actually getting better as time went on. And they kept it up. Because they had two different agendas, you know, to wipe out the world. First wipe out Europe from Jews, and then wipe out the world from Jews, and so on. So the Poles themselves, they never, until this very day, never accepted any degree of a complicity that they had anything to do with this. That in local Poles cooperated, God forbid, they were all tzaddikim. They saw themselves as also victims. They saw themselves as victims, and victims both of Germany and Russia. And I'm not saying they weren't victims of Russia and Germany. They were. But there was no small amount of Polish cooperation at the end of the day of revealing where Jews were being hidden by other Polish families who were Hasidei Umot Olam, and those Polish families paid for it with their lives. So there was no small amount of Polish cooperation. But the Poles never wanted to admit that this was a Jewish issue. So Polish citizens were murdered. You know, it's a terrible thing. It's part of the victimization of Poland. So that's why they have this big thing of the first transport to Auschwitz. And if you don't know what Auschwitz is, started there. You know, 1940, June. Okay. So I mentioned this because you'll see that the picking of the date of Yom HaShoah is also interesting, why that date. But if we go back to the 20th of Sivan, so you have all these kinota written from the Middle Ages, and now we're talking about an event of the 17th century. In order to give a certain amount of sanction and authority to the date, they preferred latching on to a date that already existed, at least in some community, was once upon a time observed as a fast day. Now many times there were local, very local fast days. And one of them was after the pogroms of the Crusades of 1096 in some communities in Ashkenaz, where Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi's grandson, already knows about this and writes kinot for that particular fast day on the 20th of Sivan. And all of these kinot that were written by these medieval poets, whether it's Shlomo HaKatan or Rabbeinu Gershom and others, these refer to events that surrounded the 20th of Sivan fast day that was known in the Middle Ages because of the Crusades. And in the 17th century, whereas hardly any people were fasting the 20th of Sivan, what they simply did was they pumped some halachic energy into a fast day that existed in the calendar anyway, and they said, let's fast it on the 20th. That's why they picked the 20th of Sivan. But also, in order to upgrade it and get people to really observe it, they chose to say the slichot that were written 500-600 years before. So that it would give some authority. It's almost similar to what our Rebbe Derub, Zichron Lebracha, he had a problem with modern-day kinot for the Shoah. Now, we happen to have some very, very moving kinot for the Shoah. One is a British minister, Rabbi Abraham Rosenfeld. So that's a famous one. It's a very, very good kinah. But no less, in terms of powerful, but much shorter, is the Bub of a Rebbe, who survives the Shoah. And he was the one who moves the Bubba of a movement from Williamsburg to Borough Park. It becomes a great center. I think he died in the year 2001, 2002, Mashiach Gazeh. Shloima Halbestam, he authored a kina. And others, there's somebody by the name of Bichla. I don't have all the names, but there are modern day kinot for the Shoah. The Rebbe's of the opinion that in order to write kinot for the Shoah, you have to be blessed with a measure of Ruach HaKodesh that he believed didn't exist today. And therefore, he always said, in his shurim on the Tisha B'Av in Boston, that when I read the kinot of the Middle Ages and I read about the collapse of these great Jewish centers, I also think of Volozhin and Radin and Mir and Kamenitz and Vilna and so on. I have in mind. I say I don't need extra keynote to. It already says Magencia and Spire and Worms and so on. Fine, that's what it says. Those are the 1096. But already by extension, it's everything that I'm familiar with. He says, and there's really no need. That was his opinion. And a lot of people never bought into this, except those who felt that they did not want to start up with writing new kinot. The Rav was also concerned that it would get out of hand, and everybody, every Tom, Dick, and Harry would start authoring kinot, and they wouldn't stand up to anything of substance. And he says, better not to have any kinot add-ons. But it's possible that the Chachamim of the 17th century also had that opinion, that they did not see themselves as worthy of authoring kinot, and therefore they wanted kinot for this for this fast day of the 20th of Sivan. So what they did was they simply used the existing kinot of the 11th and 12th century for the fast of the 20th Sivan that somehow petered out with time, but now they're going to resurrect it and use those kinot. I think that's of interest. Having said all that, we do have some kinot that were authored by giants in the 17th century, and one is another one of the great leading halachis of the 17th and 18th, early late 17th century. And he's known as the Tosfot Yom Tov. His name is Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller. Some of us may remember the name Rav Chaim Heller from New York. Zichron Lebracha, the Rav took particularly good care of him personally. Chaim Heller was a Talmud Chacham from Lita who migrated to Berlin between wars and ended up being a teacher of Tanakh, of all things, in the Beit Midrash of the Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminary in Berlin. The Rav came as a youngster to Berlin in the university. He studied there, not formally, but he studied with Rav Chaim Heller. And then when they both made it to the United States, Rav Chaim Heller saw the Rav as his champion in Halacha. Tables turned around a little bit. His great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller. And that's the author of the Tosfot Yom Tov, not to be confused with the Tosfot on the page of a Gemara. That's Middle Ages. Now we're talking about a commentary on Mishnayot. This is all pre-Pinchas Kehati. Before Pinchas Kehati, so if you wanted to break your head on a Mishnah, you'll study Rabbeinu Avadya mi Bar Tanura. There's a street not far from here, Bar Tanura Street. And that's Rabbi Avadya mi Bar Tanura. And the other side of the page of a printed Mishnayot is Tosfot Yom Tov. So Tosfot Yom Tov is this Rabbi Yom Tov Lipman HaKoyen Heller, who had a great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson, not only Rav Chaim Heller, but also one of the chief of staffs of the Israeli army, Lipman Shachak. That the Lipman comes from that name, Yom Tov Lipman, Akoyan, Yom Tov Heller. And he was a direct descendant of the Tosfot Yom Tov. So this is something of interest as well. And just a little tidbit is that when you go to the cemetery of the Ramah in Krakow, where the Ramah and his family have the Mizrach, they have the prime area of the cemetery. Tosfot Yom Tov is buried out in left field, deep out at the next to the retaining wall at the end, where only simple people were buried there. And you know, why is he buried there? This man is a luminary. And right next to it is a matzeva that's illegible. But just in the last few years, people started lighting Nerot Neshama there and putting stones on it. And it's totally like an anonymous kever. When you start seeing things like Nerot Neshama and a lot of stones, you know that there's some story here. But this was the story that Shlomo Kalbach made famous of Yasala the miser, Yasala Kamtzan, where the story of this very wealthy person in Krakow who didn't want to contribute anything to tzedakah, and they called him Yasala the Kamtzan, the miser. And he dies one day, and they bury him at the end of the cemetery, nobody's going to look at his kever ever, ever, ever. And what happens the next day, and the day after, many, many poor people of Krakow who would have a unknown donor of food to their doorstep when they woke up in the morning, almost like man came down from Shemayim, it stopped suddenly. And after a few days, they realized that Yosel HaKamtzan was actually providing for the poor of Krakow, and he was renamed Yosel HaKamtzan HaKadosh. That, and the Tosfot Yom Tov asked to be buried next to Yosel HaKamtzan HaKadosh. Okay? So, you know, you talk about, you know, preferential treatment in terms of where you want to be buried. You want to be buried next to this Rav and that Rav and that Rav. He wanted to be buried next to Yosel HaKamtzan HaKadosh. Now, whether the story, you know, this is like the stories of Rav Beryl Moin, right? Did that happen or could have happened or should have happened, right? So, I'm not the you know, vouching for the authenticity of the story, but that's the story, and it's the way Shlomo Kalbach, you know, says it. So you have here all these keynote for today's date, the 20th of Sivan. Now, how does this all relate to the Rambam, going back to the 12th century? Source number one is the Sefer Mitzvot, the reason that we have assembled here today. From the Mitzvot Asay 59, Nuntet, HaMitzvah HaNuntet, the 59th positive mitzvah, Shetzivanu litkoa b'chatzotzot b'mikdash im hakravat kol korban b'korbanei ha-moadim. That was supposed to sound off the trumpets, the chatzotzot in the Beit Mikdash, with the offering of the korbanot of Yom Tov. As it says, we just read it last Shabbat, uv'yom simchatchem moadachem v'rashay chodshechem utkatem b'chatzotzot al alotechem val zevchei shalmechem vayu lachem lezikaron lefnei Hashem lukechem. A mitzvah. So, what's the next pasuk? Ki tavo milchama ba'artzechem o atzar hatzoreratchem v'ariotem b'chatzotzot. And if there'll be a war or another calamity that will befall you, you shall sound out with the trumpets v'ariotem b'chatzotzot and a kadosh bo v'nizkartem, a kadosh will remember you. So what exactly does that mean? What's the difference between the mitzvah of sounding out the chatzotzot, the trumpets for the korban, and sounding out for the chatzotzot for the war or calamity situation? So you have to realize from here we learn something phenomenal about the sounds of the shofarot and the chatzotzot. The language of the shofar and chatzotzot is basically two sounds. One is a tekiah and one is a trua. A tekiah is a straight sound, that we all know. But what does a straight sound signify? It signifies all clear, everything's good, everything hunky-dory, everything's happy. You always have a tekiah when we're talking about something great. Tika b'shofar gadol l'cherotenu. It's a tekiah to announce, right? V'ya b'yom ahu yitaka b'shofar gadol l'vav v'din b'eretz Ashur. The announcement of Kibbutz Goliot is done with a tekiah. In a hachtarat melech, a coronation of a king, v'yitka'u. And they sounded off at tekiah. And here, of Yom Simchatchem, Moadechem, Roshei Chodshechem, and a Yom Tov, Utkatem b'chatzotzot. A tekiah is sounded off. Trua is a wavering sound. It's the ambulance sound, basically. Or it's the sound of the, you know, the siren get into the sealed rooms. That's what it is. Woo, 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 woo. And it basically causes a person to go into a certain amount of stress. And that's the object. That's the object of it, to put you into stress and to shock you. Rega. It's not business as usual. There's an imminent danger. It could be a mortal danger. Protect yourself. Do something about it. Get into a hide. Whatever you have to do. V'chi tavol milchama b'artzechem or atzar atzoreretchem. It doesn't say utkatem b'chatzotzchot. It says b'hareyotem b'chatzotzchot. It's a sound of a trua. It's a different sound completely. And how did Chazal know that Rosh Hashanah is Yom HaDin? Doesn't say anywhere in the Chumash that Rosh Hashanah is the Yom HaDin, as the Paitan, you know, gives it to us. Rosh Hashanah yiketevun, Yom Tzom Kippur yiketemun, kama yavun, kama yiberun, mi yichye, mi yamut, mi bikitzo, mi lo bikitzo. I mean, it's a frightening moment. Where do you see it in the Chumash? You see it one place. Yom Trua Yelechem. While this mitzvah is the mitzvah to sound the Trua, while there is a halacha l'Moshe Mesinai, that says you sandwich the trua with the tekiah before and after. Tekiah is not a principal sound for Rosh Hashanah, but it's a preparatory sound and a ending sound. Every trua, and there's a machloket, whether the trua is what we call a shvarim, tru, 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 or we call a trua, tu, 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 or maybe it's the combination of both because we're not sure, so we do that too. But whatever the trua is, it's always sandwiched with in between two tkiyot. So the tkiyah is not a principal sound. It's always a preparatory sound and it's an ending sound. Tkiyah, shvarim trua, tkiyah. Tkiyah, shvarim, tkiyah. Tkiyah, trua, tkiyah. The tkiyah is before and after. There's the before and after sounds. And there's a lot of Hamalenic idea that goes along with this baggage here. And that is that even though Am Yisrael may be in a tough situation, a trua situation, let's call it, a mashber, a calamity situation, there's always a tomorrow of a tkiyah. Am Yisrael is not going down so fast. It always ends with a tkiyah. We may not live to see the tkiyah, but there's a tkiyah at the end of the day. One of the great darshanim, just yesterday I saw the Sefer at the International Book Fair in the Tachana Rishonan, a few steps from here. But we spoke in the Warsaw Ghetto of the Rebbe from Piacenta, Rav Kolonimus Shapira, who gave drushas in the Warsaw Ghetto in 42 and 43 and 44. He ends up dying in 44 in Trevniki. He survives. They take him out. He's not sent to Treblinka. He's one of the few that wasn't sent to Treblinka, but he dies in another camp called Trevniki, which I only heard about for the first time in the Demenyuk trial. I heard the name Trevniki. But okay, but he gave drashot, and many of those drashot survived. You could see that in spite of all the pain that was going on there, he was still infusing the people with some sliver of hope. That Am Yisrael said, even if we don't have hope for tomorrow, Am Yisrael has hope for tomorrow. And therefore, it's still worth our whiles to still say Shema Yisrael. Because there was good reason to drop Shema Yisrael and insert other things that wouldn't be pleasant to say or to hear. But he that's what he did. And because the idea is that every trua ends with a tkiyah. And every set of truot ends with a tkiyah gedolah. And it's going to be a great moment for Am Yisrael, whether an individual lives to see it or not. But at least he believes that it's going to end with a tkiyah gedolah. So here the Torah tells us in Parshat Baalotcha that if there's on these days of Simcha, you shall sound tkiot with the trumpets at the time of the Korban. And if it's a day of tragedy, of war, so you sound truot. Now it's interesting that the Rambam, here in the Sefer Mitzvot, he sees both of these psukim as one mitzvah. It's the mitzvah to sound the chatzotzrot on Yom Tov, and it's a mitzvah to sound the chatzotzrot on wartime or days of tzara, albeit a different sound. One is a tkiyah, one is a trua, but the common thread here, they're both blowing a trumpet. That's how the Rambam understood this. Because the parsha begins, Aseh lecha shtei chatzotzrot kesef, miksha venasu de'edav, masat machanot. And it was used in the midbar, the desert, to move the folks, to announce that we are rolling. And then, once these trumpets are part of the baggage of the Mishkan, it's to be used in future generations for A and B. So the A and B, the Rambam lists as one mitzvah. Now, and you see it clearly here, because after he mentions on the second line, Utkatem b'chatzotzot, it says, U'biur amru, it says in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, Shemitzvat hayom b'chatzotzot. Ukvar hitbaru mitzvah mishpatei mitzvah zu besifrei. The details are found in the Medrash Sifrei. VeRosh Hashanah in Masechet Rosh Hashanah v'Ta'anit in Masechet Ta'anit. V'chein anachnu mitzuvim litkoa b'chatzotzrot. So here I'm not responsible for the word litkoa, but it really should be lahariya b'chatzotzrot. Beitot hatzorach in times of need. V'hatzarot means times of desperate need. And tzarot, kishenitzak lifnei Hashem yitalev. When we're calling out to God, it should go along with this blowing of the trumpets. It should augment our tefillah. Where Rambam is basically saying that in times of tzara, what we really have to do is daven. We have to turn to Kadosh Baruch Hu and articulate what's on our minds. But there's a mitzvah that it should go with it, these blowings. Now we don't do this today because we don't have a Beit Din. But nevertheless, this was the mitzvah. So there are many, many who count mitzvot, who say, one second, these are two different mitzvot. One is a situation of simcha, Yom Tov, and a Yom Tov in Beit Mikdash, you blow the chatzotzot with the korban. And the other mitzvah is in time of tragedy and need and desperation, you sound out the chatzotzot as part of your tefillah. And they count it as two different mitzvot in the scheme of 613. But we see from source number one, mitzvah aseh nuntet, that the Rambam puts the two of them into one framework. And it must be something more common than just the technical thing, that it's the trumpet, because even the blowing is different. The mitzvah of simcha necessitates a tkiah, and the mitzvah of tefillah necessitates a trua, bahariyotem. The Torah differentiates between the two, utkatem b'chatzotzot and bahariyotem b'chatzotzot. So why does the Rambam put these two into one framework? So let's look at source number two. In source number two, this is the Rambam Hilchot Ta'aniyot, the laws of fasting. And he begins by saying, mitzvat aseh min haTorah, lizok ulahariya b'chatzotzot. The mitzvah, the biblical mitzvah is to yell, lizok is a type of spontaneous tefillah, and to sound out the trumpets with a trua, al kol tzara shetavol latzibur. Right? We don't have to delineate right now what a tzara is, as if Am Yisrael doesn't know what a tzara is. Shenemar, as it says, al tzar ha-tzara etchem v'arayotem b'chatzotzot. Klomar, that is to say, kol davar sheyitzer lechem, kigon, it could be batzoret, it could be a famine, dever, it means the animals, the flock is dying, arbet, locust, which can ruin your whole field, your whole flock. Ukiyotze behen, or anything like that, of that magnitude, zaku alehem v'ariyu. You should yell, Hakadosh Baruch Hu, and sound out the shofarot. Next paragraph, halacha bet. V'davar ze midarkei hatshuvahi. And this is part of the tshuva process. What is he trying to tell us? Yes, you can daven Hakadosh Baruch Hu, but you must recognize that if Am Yisrael was afflicted with some type of tzara, it's not because they were great tzaddikim, but something went sour in terms of their religious life, or religious / social life, and requires tikkun, requires correction. So you better figure out what it is, and correct it, and then turn to God and ask that they should take away the tzara. And this is called Darkei HaTshuva. Bizman shetavot tzara v'yizaku aleha v'yariyu, yed'u akol, everybody will understand. Shibiglal maaseim haraim hora lehem. This came about because of evil deeds. Kakatuv, as it says, avonotechem hitu in Yirmiyahu. V'zehu shiyigrom lehem lasir atzara me'alehem. And this procedure of recognizing that you have to rectify the bad deeds and you move it along with tefillah and with the chatzotzot, so we hope Kadosh Baruch Hu will take away the remove the calamity. But then in the next paragraph, Aval im lo yizaku v'lo yariyu, if you don't do this, but what do? You say, El yomru, davar ze mimin ha-gaulam ira lanu, v'tzara zu nikra nikreit. The word coincidence. You know, bad luck. It hit us. You know, it could have hit the neighbors. Could have hit the next country. But it was a bad stroke of fate that it hit us. What can you do? A person that sees calamity as simply a statistical issue. You know, a certain amount of people in a population, you know, get a particular disease. So, okay, Nebuch, you lucked out badly that you got this disease. If a person says that the tzara is just nikra nikreit, from the word mikriyut, which means it just happens, harezu derech achzariyut, it's a very, very cruel thing to do. Goremet lehem lidavek b'masim harayim. That's not going to, they'll never be stimulated to do away with their bad deeds. They won't even think they're doing anything bad. V'tosif ha-tzara, tzarot acherot. Kadosh Baruch Hu is just going to compound the tzara. Hu shekatuv b'Torah, this is what it says in the Tochacha, in Parshat Bechukotai, v'alachtem imi b'keri, v'alachti imachem b'chamat keri. Klomar, that is to say, ki sh'avi alechem tzara, kedei sh'tashuvu, when I bring already a tzara, as an indication that you should do tshuva, im tomru shu keri, if you say it's just a coincidence, osif lechem chamat oto keri, I will pile on the keri, the coincidence, as if to say, I'll make a few more coincidences until you realize there is no coincidence. The word coincidence doesn't exist in the lexicon. In theological lexicon of Yadut, there's no such thing as coincidence. Not such thing. Right, so that's an issue that is dealt with by all the Balei Machshava. All the Balei Machshava, is that while a Kadosh Baruch Hu ordains or even preordains things, within that framework, there's room for individual expression to do or not to do. So everybody dealt with it. The leading the pack is the Rambam. And the Rambam actually tells us that on the Pasuk in Yeshayahu, Ki lo machshavotai machshavotechem v'lo darchechem d'rachai, that Kadosh Baruch Hu operating a frequency of intellect that's not our human intellect, and therefore we are living with a contradiction, he said. This is the great Rambam. We're living with a contradiction. You must necessarily accept this and that, even though this and that somewhat contradict. Because if you say Kadosh Baruch Hu, there's no coincidence and nothing just happens, but everything has a master plan, then really there's no free will. That's what Jerry's saying. There's really no free will. No free will, so there's no accountability. There's no schar v'onesh. Why should you be held accountable if you couldn't do anything? So the Rambam basically says, no, there is free will, and it's not a fake. It's real. But the Kadosh Baruch Hu knows in his way how you're going to choose. But the choice was really yours. There are a lot of different ways to try to understand it philosophically and mathematically and whatnot. This year, on the trip to Poland, we went to a town called Izbich. And Izbich was the Rebbe Rav Liner. He's the grandfather of the Trelet, Radzina Rebbe. We're not talking about the Trelet, now we're talking about his grandfather. And he wrote the Sefer Me'ah Shiloach, which caused a schism in the world of Hasidut between the mainstream Hasidic line from the town of Psishcha, who was Rav Simcha Bunim, who was a Talmud of the Yudia Kadosh. He was known as the Heilig Yid, Rav Yosef Yitzchak, who was a Talmud of the Choyzer from Lublin, who was a Talmud of Rav Elimelech from Lizhansk. I know it because I just did this last week, you know, like, otherwise I wouldn't know this. So this is the mainstream Hasidut, which then after Rav Simcha Bunim from Psishcha moves to Kotsk, from Menachem Mendel from Kotsk, and then moves to the first Rebbe of Ger. So there's a real mainstream line here, but Izbich was a little bit of a outcast, and he had a very radical ideas that he said that Ratzon Hashem, the will of God, includes everything a human being does, including his averus. So if it includes his averot, so what's wrong with the averus? So he struggles to try to understand where free will even comes in. But you can see already the danger. You can see already the danger, and it caused a schism in the world of Hasidut. Some were outraged to even hear this. I mean, the fact that there was a schism between the Misnagdim and the Chasidim, so the Misnagdim, they were against all the Chasidim. But in the world of Hasidut, they were against Izbitz, because they thought he was totally out of line. Totally, totally out of line. But he had some very, very offbeat, off-center ideas that really touched on the question of where's free will in this whole enterprise if you believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is behind not only the mitzvahs but also the averus. So anyway, the Rambam believes that we do have free will, it's just that we don't understand the conflict, the contradiction. Yeah,
but you have Yom Kippur.
What?
You have Yom Kippur.
Of course you have Yom Kippur, you have everything that... That effort, not just Yom Kippur, but we can ask for forgiveness and receive it throughout the year. The whole business of a free will leads to the possibility of tshuva. And without free will, you can close up Yom Kippur, obviously. So here, the Rambam goes on to say, in Halacha Dalid, umidivrei sofrim, and rabbinically, litanot al kol tzara. Not only is there a cheshbon nefesh of tshuva with tefillah, za'akah, spontaneous tefillah, with the sounding of the shofarot, but it should go with fasting. It should go with fasting, achi yiruchamu min ha-shamayim until the Kadosh Baruch Hu has compassion on us. So you see that not eating is a rabbinic add-on. That we see from this Rambam. And the Rambam now is talking about general tzarot. Obviously he's not talking historic, he's talking if this ever happens, this is the way a Jew is supposed to respond to tragedy. In source number 3, the Rambam does talk about historic tzara, because it's the last chapter of Hilchot Taniyot, Perek Hei, fifth chapter, and there he says, Yesham yamim shekol Yisrael mitanim behem, mibnei atzarot she'eru behem. There are some fast days that Am Yisrael fast because of the historic tragedy that occurred on those dates. For what purpose? So you might think to commemorate the tragedy. Now, I'm just going to jump. In the Shulchan Aruch, all it says there is that there are days that Am Yisrael fast because of the tragedies. And the impression is to commemorate the tragedy. You commemorate the destruction of Beit HaMikdash, you commemorate the crashing of the walls of Yerushalayim on the 17th of Tammuz, you commemorate the siege around Yerushalayim on the 10th of Tammuz, and the assassination of Gedalia and some Gedalia. These are commemorative fast days. That's the way the Shulchan Aruch seems to present it. What's interesting is the Mishnah Berurah doesn't buy into that. And in his commentary, he simply tacks on, word for word, verbatim, what the Rambam says here. Kidei means in order to, because the Rambam explains that it's not historic commemoration. There's no need to commemorate the Churban. There's no need to commemorate the fact that Babylonians lay siege around Yerushalayim on the 10th of Tevet. It's to stimulate us to do tshuva for today. But it's very helpful to associate a target date, a historic target date, without doing tshuva. You might say, okay, let's do tshuva. I don't have time tomorrow. Tomorrow, the next day, the next day. But if there's a target date that's of historic value, it gives a little bit more impetus that I should deal with my issues of today. And that's what he says, kedei la'orer halvavot, to stimulate the heart, liftoch darkei ha'tshuva, to promote the procedure, the process of tshuva, v'yeze zichron l'maseinu ha'ra'im. And this will remind us of what's going on in our days, of our evil deeds. Umasei avoteinu shahaya kimaseinu ata. That, you know why they had trouble? They also had avirot. So do we. Ad shegarem lahem vilanu otan atzarot. A lot of times, history repeats itself. So just like they had tzarot, we have tzarot. Shebezichrom dvarim elu nashuv leitiv. If we remember all these things, it will promote tshuva, and we will do, it will be good for us. Shenemar, v'tvadu et avonam v'tavon avotam. That's how he explains the problematic pasuk, that's found in the Tochacha, in the Parshat Bechukotai, that why should you say vidui, why should you say confession on something that your parents or grandparents did? It contradicts a pasuk in Sefer, in Parshat Ki Teitzei, in Dvarim. Lo yomtu avot al banim, uvanim lo yomtu al avot, ish b'chet'o yumato. Torah says clearly, nobody's going to be held responsible for his father's sins, no person will be held responsible for his son's sins. Everybody has their own fire. Ish b'chet'o yumato. Everybody will be punished for their own chatoim. You don't have to worry about the others. So, but then the Torah says that you say confession, vidui, for your sins and for the previous generation. We say it, aval anachnu vavoteinu chatanu, ashamnu bagadnu, right? We say it in the vidui, aval anachnu vavoteinu chatanu. So why is that so? It contradicts the pasuk, ish b'chet'o yumatu. So here Rambam gives an explanation that because we sensitize ourselves to the tshuva process because of what happened in yesteryear, so there's a type of collaboration of our vidui with the vidui of the previous generations, where we're nurturing from the tzara, the historic tzara, and that's promoting our tshuva movement of today. There's some type of a chibur. The Rav Zichron Lebracha had a completely different understanding of the pasuk v'tvadu et avonam et avon atam. I don't want to take too much time from this, but I'll just give you the, as they say, on one foot, a regular chat. He said that many times a person goes through life and something is clearly a mitzvah or something is clearly an aveira. But many times you do things that's, it's very parv. It's not milchiks, it's not fleishiks, it's not an aveira, it's not a mitzvah, it's reshut. Okay, you did something, whatever you did, you did. You took a decision. But there are occasions where you do something, you take a decision, that at the moment it's not a mitzvah, it's not a vera, except that it has long-range implications. And this action that you took, or this declaration, or this whatever, you somehow, with time, develops into something very good, develops into a mitzvah. And on the other hand, it can develop into an avera. And the Rav said that when the Gemara says that on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, Sifrei Chayim v'Sifrei Meitim Ptuchim Lefanav, as the reason why we don't say Hallel on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, because it's inappropriate, normally explains Sifrei Chayim, Sifrei Meitim Ptuchim Lefanecha, that the books of life, book of life, book of death, is the question of Mi Yechia Mi Yamut. Kadosh Baruch Hu is inscribing, either you're here or you're there. And that's why now's not the time to say Hallel. You know, that would sound like a bribery or whatever, Shochan. Can't do that. Now's not the time for Hallel. That's how normally it's explained. But the Rav said, no. Kadosh Baruch Hu not only opens up the Sifrei Chayim, the books of those who are alive, but he opens up the books of those who have already passed away. Why? What's Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur for them? They're long gone. He says, because of unfinished business. Unfinished business. You have Kaliyot, it could be somebody did something 10 years ago, 100 years ago, that impacted later on in history and became a mitzvah. Became a mitzvah, that neshama is going to be rewarded retroactively. Or became an avera. Even though when you did it, you didn't even know it was an avera. So, all right, so it's bishogeg, inadvertent. But it turned out bad. So who's going to say vidui for that avera? Man's dead already. So Rav said, the obligation for vidui gets passed down by Yerusha. It's part of the inheritance. And that's what it means, bitvadu et avonam, betavon avotam. to say vidui for the forefathers for unfinished business that the neshamot should have. And the Rav said that's why the original institution of Yizkor was for Yom Kippur. Only later, after the 1648, the Gzirot Tachvatat, the Chamanishka pogroms, was it expanded in Eastern Europe for the Chagim, for Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot. But in Western Europe, until this very day, the German Jewish community of Frankfurt only have Yizkor and Yom Kippur. That was the original minhag. They didn't have it for the Chagim. And the original minhag had to do with the fact that we wanted to incorporate the names of the departed into our vidui. And that's why we say it before Yom Kippur, before Musaf on Yom Kippur, before the Chazan gets up there and reenacts the Avodah, of which includes the vidui, that we want the names of all the previous generations to also be part and parcel of the vidui. Betvadu et avonam, bet avon avotam. And he said that you even see a remez, an allusion from the Kriyat Torah of Yom Kippur, which we read the beginning of Parshat Achrimot, which makes a lot of sense, because that's where Aaron HaKohen receives the instructions for Yom Kippur. How does it begin? Acharei mot shnei b'nei Aaron, b'kovatam lifnei Hashem v'yamutu. And it says, Daber al Aaron. But after the deaths of the two sons of Aaron, I mean, that's Parsha Shmini. It's behind us already, that episode. Why bring it up? Why open up a wound on Yom Kippur? The Rav said this was Yizkor. That at the moment of the giving of the Avodah of Yom Kippur, it was a mention of the deaths of Nadav and Avihu. That there was Askarat Neshamot. There's a type of remez that Yom Kippur is the appropriate time for Yizkor. So here the Rambam already gives us an inkling that you can have historic, you can have a fast day for an event that's of a calamity situation, and you use a historic event. So which historic event do we classically use? Tisha B'Av, Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, Asar B'Teves, and Tzom Gedalia. That's what those. That's in the calendar. And that's based on the fact that they have roots in Tanakh. Because in the beginning of Bayit Sheni, when Zechariah Navi, beginning of Bayit Sheni, was asked a shayla chatit, ha'efkeh tzom ha'chamishi. What's the deal? We're building Bayit Sheni. Should we continue fasting Tisha B'Av? Should I continue crying and wailing on the fast of the fifth month, which is up? Comes the great answer. The Tzom HaRavi, Tzom HaChamishi, Tzom HaShvi, Tzom HaSiri, Yeh LeBeit Yudah LeSoson LeSimcha LeMoadim Tovim, which is a question, when will these four fast days become Yom Tov? That's Rambam says, Yimot HaMashiach, they'll become Yom Tovim. But until then, they're still on the books. But what you see from here is that in Tanakh, you have the four fast days of Tammuz and Av and Tishrei, Tzom Gedalia and Teveit. They're there. So these become the fast days. We're not commemorating the event, but we're using these events as a springboard for our own issues today. But what you see from all of this is that it was appropriate what the Vad Arba Aratzot did in 1640, after the 1648 pogroms, Gezerot Tachfatat, to link the fast day, the regional fast day, to the 20th of Sivan, a fast day that already existed from the days of Rabbeinu Gershom and Rabbeinu Tam. That they did this because this was important as a stimulus to the day. So now we see why the usage of the Slichot for Kaf Sivan came from the medievals. And not only what I said earlier, that the Rav felt, you know, like in the name of the Rav, that they may have felt lesser degree of Ruach HaKodesh in order to author. So the reason I brought up the author of the Tosfot Yom Tov, because the author of the Tosfot Yom Tov, who's buried next to Yosel HaKamtzan HaKadosh in Krakow, he authored a kina for the Gzirot Tachvatat. So there is a kina that in his name. So some of the contemporaries did write kinot. So you see there's precedent for that also, and certainly the Bubba of a Rebbe didn't think it was out of line, Rav Shlomo Halberstam, Zichron Levracha, for him to author a kina for the Shoah. He didn't think it was out of line at all. And now, for the wrap-up, is Rav Moshe Feinstein on source number 4. This is the beginning of this section began with the letter Yud Aleph, which means 11. There are 11 points to this Shaila. It was really a very complex. It was a series of discussions that a great benefactor of Torah, and I'd love to tell you the whole story maybe next week, Joseph Gruss, Zichron Levracha, who gave money, tons of money to YU and to 1975, the Rav told me that he had donated already $100 million to Am Yisrael, to all different causes, $100 million to Am Yisrael, and the Rav told me Joseph Gruss. Yeah, I asked him what he did for a living. You know, so he said he was in oil. He was in oil. You know, he marketed oil. He had a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. And if you would have given him Matanos Levyanim on Purim, surely he would not have been Yaitza. That's for sure. So the man was very, very wealthy. Over $100 million to Am Yisrael, different various causes. And as the Rav looked at him and he said, and he still had some change. You know? Nishar Odef. Yeah, change. All right. Nishkin Rachmunus. So it was a discussion with Rav Moshe's grandson, Rav Mordechai Tendler, who's the son of Rav Moshe Tendler, and Rav Mordechai Tendler brought it to his grandfather, Rav Feinstein's attention, and he authors a point-by-point tshuva. He had a bunch of questions about whether we should put up monuments for people who perished in the Shoah. Should we put up monuments anywhere? Should there be a matzeva? Or does a matzeva really have to do with the makom of the kfura? And if you can't put it by a makom kfura, forget about it. The truth of the matter is, without asking Rav Moshe Feinstein, many, many people have put up something, memorial plaques in shul, and some people have gone to the extent of going to the cemetery of Lodz, where they know that the family comes from Lodz. Right? We just saw this week, where families came and they put up plaques in memory of the family who perished in Chelmno, or they perished in Auschwitz, but they know the family came from Lodz, so they figure they'll put up a plaque in the cemetery of Lodz, you know, to the family. People do this. Or even better, here in Hamanuchot, to write on a matzeva all the other names of the mishpacha. You're burying somebody who happened to have had a brother, or this or that, who perished in a Shoah. Should there be some place on this world that the names should be, you know, visible? It's something that's done. Rav Moshe Feinstein takes a stand, a rather unpopular stand on this issue, whether there's any value to it or not. So, all right, so maybe there's no halachic value to it, but certainly psychological value there is. But one of the questions that Gruss asked was, well, how come we don't have a fast day for the Shoah? I mean, it's a very good question. He's not the first, not the last to ask that question. So Rav Moshe Feinstein deals with this, the tshuva was written in Tavshin Mem Bet. And Rav Moshe dies in Tavshin Mem Hei, 3 years later. I mean, Rav Moshe is an old man already when he deals with this. He says, "B'tam shalotik nu yom kavur etanitu tefila lezecha harugei Shoah." And the reason that we did not establish a specific day for a fast day and tefila, remembering the day to remember those who perished in the Shoah. Ubedvar hagzerot shaboteinu avraham rabim nergu erech asara pamim shishim ribo. Shishim ribo is the number of those who came out of Mitzrayim, 600,000. But it's 10 times that number, which you know is 6 million. Aidei harashaim Hitler v'chavirav yemach shemam v'zichram. Shemearu'i haya, harei haya tzorech eze yom kavur letanitu tfila. Shetama malat kvodo, the questioner is asking, wondering, al shadayin lo nasa klum. It's now 1982, and nothing's been done. Hine bikinot shel kol Yisrael omrim b'tisha b'av mifurash shema shelo tiknu yom miuchad etanit ulevechi al gzerot maseh hatzlav shayu gzerot b'chol medinot Yurib shegaru sham rov yudim b'nechrevu kama ayarot ukrachim v'nikra al shem shnat taf taf nun vav v'gam b'eretz Yisrael agu sham arbe yudim mishum de'en likpo od yom letanit ulevechi. Shelachen tzarich laskiram bekinot deomim betisha ba'av al chuban hamikdash. Rav Moshe says, take a look. There was so many people, so many communities were decimated at the end of the 11th century and the beginning of the 12th century in the Crusades. And you see, nobody picked the date, a specific date. Although we talked about this Chaf Sivan, and it was very, very regional. Rav Moshe makes a distinction between regional and it's something that affects all of Am Yisrael. If it's something that affects all of Am Yisrael, stick with Tisha B'Av. You're allowed to graft upon Tisha B'Av extra themes, additional themes, beyond the destruction of Beit HaMikdash. Which indeed, if you understand the keynote that we say on Tisha B'Av, there are many, many medieval paitanim who didn't write about the Churban, the destruction of Beit HaMikdash, but they wrote about their Churbanot of Europe. And that would be appropriate. When Menachem Begin L'Avashon was elected Prime Minister in 77, May, and he came to the United States for an official visit in July and August, so he met up with the Lubavitch Rebbe, Rav Moshe Feinstein, and the Rav. And and he had different things to talk to them on their agenda, but there was one question that was clearly common. He wanted to know if it would be a good idea to move Yom HaShoah for the 27th of Nisan to Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av should become the Yom HaShoah. All three answered affirmatively. That's a good idea. And the reason why it was rejected, because the education ministry, they said, it's the summer vacation, and we'd never be able to properly educate the kids to the Shoah if we're in the middle of the summer. So that's why it fell. But they all felt that this was a good idea. It was a good idea. I'll just tell you that I know from inside what happened was the Rebbe lived in Brooklyn, New York, and Rav Moshe lived in Manhattan. In some months, the Rebbe was in his home in Boston. He wasn't in New York City. So Begin made plans to visit the Rav in Boston, make a special trip. And the Rav heard about this, and he said, nothing doing, you're the prime minister, and I have to come see you. So Begin sent a message, but you're the Gedol Ador, it's not right that you should come to see me. No, because the Rav said, Kvod HaMalchut demands that I come to see you. So Rav Moshe said, so the Rav, May Begin sent to the Rav, but you're the Gedol Ador, and I really should see you. So the Rav sent back and he said, if you already admit that I'm the Gedol Ador, I'm paskening a shaila that I have to come see you. Yeah. This I heard from Rabbi Yisrael Miller, Zechon Lebracha, who was then vice president of Yeshiva University. So the Rav actually came to New York special to see Menachem Begin. So this actually is one of the issues that came up about the moving Yom HaShoah. But the Rav Moshe says that even in Gzeirat Tachfetat in 1648, with the decision of the Vat Arba Aratzot, it was because of a regional issue. Nobody ever suggested that this was going to be universal for Klal Yisrael, wherever they may be. And that would be okay. But the Shoah had universal implications. The danger, the threat was worldwide. The ambition of the Nazis was to take over the world. The Third Reich was going to be taking over the world. Taking over the world means exterminating the world from Jews. That's what the threat was. So even though they were only partially successful in their point of view, but nevertheless, it was a universal concern. And as a universal concern, the day to cry and bemoan the fact that it all happened was Tisha B'Av. And there'd be no need for a specific date in the calendar. As opposed to what happened, the reason that Chaf Sivan does enter the calendar, but it enters in the Middle Ages on a local level. It enters in 1648 on a local level as well, but the locality is a little bit wider, that's for sure. But it's certainly not all-encompassing, because when you go west of Krakow already, nobody knows from Chaf Sivan. It's totally unknown. Outside the influence of the Vat Arba Aratzot. But you have to understand also, telecommunication didn't exist then. So because they're deciding something in Lublin, doesn't mean that in Frankfurt they even knew that this was happening and so on. So there was really no way to get this across. But implicit, Rav Moshe was also saying, he doesn't say it openly, but implicit, and I think this really is a large part of the story. And let's even assume you want to say that there's room to have something that's national, that's a specific date and so on. Who's the authority to do it? Who is the authority? Which group of Rabbonim is going to get up and say it that everybody's going to accept it? It's going to, because Am Yisrael is so fragmented and everybody has their Gadol Hador, so if it doesn't come from the Ponovitch Yeshiva, they're not going to hold from it. They're not going to, even the Haredi world, they're not going to hold from it. Nobody's going to hold from it. And certainly not the secular. What's interesting is because of that, Yom HaShoah does make it into the calendar through a secular agency called the State of Israel. It does make it on some level, but there are people in the country who don't observe it. It's not their thing. Why? Because they're not here to accept these kind of decisions from the secular government. But even Asarah B'Tevet, which did emanate from the chief rabbinate, but as you know very well, there are people here in this country who don't hold from the chief rabbinate. So it's a very sad state of affairs that the show of this kind of magnitude does not have universal acceptance in terms of a date of commemoration. But it has, I would say, more people today observe Yom HaShoah than ever, the 20th of Sivan after 1648. That's no question in my mind. And that proves that the power of authority of government is actually much stronger than a rabbinic body. Because the Vat Arba Aratzot that got through the fast of the 20th of Sivan didn't do it because of the power of having Talmidei Chachamim on the Vad, but because it was an administrative body that was backed by the government of Poland to administer the needs of Klal Yisrael. So it was a type of mini-government on Polish soil for Am Yisrael. And then it worked. And you see here too, it's the law of the Knesset, so it makes it. Whether you like it or not, it's a fact. And Even Yom HaZikaron, the Chalalei Tzal, Erev, Yom HaTzmut, so we always kibbutz, so this was written in Makor Rishon, that even the Neturei Karta understand that there's a government of Israel, as much as they hate it and don't agree and everything and everything, even Neturei Karta. And the proof is, because the government decided, because of Shabbat, to move Yom HaTzmut by a day, which moved everything because of Yom HaZikaron, shouldn't be Matzah Shabbat. So when did they have the fast day in Me'er Sharim for Yom HaTzmut? Not on the 5th of Iyar, but on the 6th of Iyar, because it was a Nitcha. Who made it a Nitcha? The government. The government. So you see, they also all from the government on some level. Okay, so let me just add with a positive note of the 20th of Sivan. In 1967, the State of Israel formally annexed the east part of Yerushalayim and the Old City as part of Yerushalayim on the 20th of Sivan. So it was a big, we should remember that for Am Yisrael for generations to come. Yeah, yeah. Okay, we need a tkiyah. We need a tkiyah at the end of the day. Yeah.